Hello and welcome to the American Magazine podcast. I'm joined today by Charlie Camosi, Assistant Professor of Christian Ethics at Fordham University. Welcome, Charlie.
Hey, it's good to be here.
Now, Charlie, you have a new book out called Peter Singer and Christian Ethics Beyond Polarization, and you've written a bit about this project you have with Peter Singer. Maybe you can begin by introducing Professor Singer to us.
Well, there are some who would say that he's the best-known living philosopher in the world right now. You could disagree with that, but certainly he's in the top five. And he's best known probably for positions that you might not associate with Christian ethics at all. Certainly a pro-choice for infanticide position, a big supporter of euthanasia. In fact, he would like to say that we need to have a second Copernican revolution, this time in ethics, to fully extricate ourselves from the Christian tradition. And he's become pretty famous for not only being anti-Christian, but for the things he's for, too. So he was sort of like the intellectual heft behind the animal rights movement in the 1970s and stuff like that. So he spent the first part of his career in Australia, where he's from, and then in 1993 he got hired at Princeton to great acclaim, and actually to some infamous acclaim, too. A lot of people stopped donating to Princeton. He got hired there and stuff like that. So he's written a ton. He's written in academic journals and for academic presses, but he's also written more popular things, too, and that his big book was Animal Liberation, which is published in something like 20 languages or something like that. So he's made a name for himself not only in the academy but more broadly, and that's probably why you can at least make the argument that he's the most influential philosopher in the world right now.
Right. I remember back when he was hired at Princeton, and there were people from disability rights groups protesting outside of his classroom because of what he's written on, particularly infanticide and, you know, the kind of utilitarian approach to this kind of ethics.
The protests don't just come from sort of what you might call the Christian right or something. They also do come from the left, from disability groups. In fact, a country that's had a checkered past with regard to these issues, Germany, has essentially banned him from speaking. He's tried to speak there a number of times and actually gotten shouted down. One time a protester leapt onto the stage and ripped off his glasses and stamped on them. So with regard to sort of pro-life Christians, he's a really problematic figure, but also with sort of left-leaning disability folks, he's also really problematic too.
We're talking a bit about Peter Singer and his writings on infanticide. Can you just offer a little specifics there about what exactly argument he's making?
Sure. So his argument about infanticide is based on a sort of prior argument about something he calls speciesism. So he thinks just as we used to have racism and sexism just as part of our culture, we still do, he would say, but it's at least we're aware of it now. He says we're largely unaware of our speciesism. Now, what's speciesism? Speciesism is this idea that just belonging to the species Homo sapiens is morally valuable, or even more morally valuable than belonging to other species. Sort of like being white used to be thought of as more morally valuable than being non-white, or being male more morally valuable than being non-male. And he would say just the idea that an organism would be of the species Homo sapiens is not morally valuable at all. He would say what's morally valuable are things like the ability to feel pain, to be rational and self-aware, to have a coherent life plan, to have preferences that can be thwarted or achieved. And, you know, there are plenty of Homo sapiens out there who have none of those things. An embryo, for instance, or early to mid-level human fetus. Now, where does he get infanticide? Well, obviously, an infant has some interests, some morally valuable traits. An infant can feel pain, whatever. But he would say, so can pigs, so can chickens, so can a lot of the animals we eat. That we treat very shabbily for virtually no reason at all, or reasons that are, you know, frivolous. If we take speciesism seriously, then we have to push against it. And one way to push against it is to treat like species equally. And so if we can kill pigs for food, and pigs are more morally serious animals than our human infants, then we should be able to kill infants for equally non-serious reasons. Now, it sounds abhorrent, but think about history. For most of human history, abortion and infanticide were considered very equivalent, right? You would get rid of infants that were born that didn't meet the criteria, and Singer points this out. He says it wasn't until the victory of the Judeo-Christian tradition that we started thinking anything about infanticide as being very serious at all. So essentially, this is part of the Copernican revolution that he wants to have. He wants to say, let's get rid of Christian speciesism, this fantasy that all human beings are made in the image of God or something like that, and let's get down to brass tacks. Let's talk about what's morally valuable.
And the Christian response to that argument is obvious, but I think we should state it, the dignity of every human life.
Right. I do think it needs to be made a little bit more in a more sophisticated way than it has been. Simply appealing every human life is precious sounds to Singer and others a little bit like saying every white life is precious or every male life is precious. You need to make an argument. But there is an argument to be made that all human life is precious, and I think it comes from the kinds of things that we are. So if it is true that we're not just a bundle of preferences at any one time, that we are kinds of things, that we're animals, that we are the same animal that we were when we were an embryo, that we were when we were a fetus, that we will be 20 years from now, then what we are not just bundles of particular preferences. What we are kinds of things that cohere over time and can't be limited to just, oh, I have this preference for this right now. I have the preference against that right now. If one of my strongest criticisms of Singer is he's got a really impoverished anthropology. To think of you or me or anybody listening to this right now is simply a bundle of preferences rather than being a unique individual that is a substance of a rational and relational nature, I think just is an impoverished understanding of what persons are. Even individuals we would agree are person.
Take us to today. Where does he stand on some of these issues, and how did you get to know him?
Well, it's interesting. He's rethinking some of his issues now, which makes this book somewhat timely, I guess. There was a conference at Oxford a little bit over a year ago where he said he was rethinking a lot of his, the fancy word is preference utilitarianism, his idea that all of ethics basically comes from trying to maximize preference satisfaction across all beings, including non-human animals. So he famously said, for instance, you know, we need to treat infants, human infants, like we would treat any other animal that had the qualities of a human infant. They're not rational or self-aware yet. In fact, maybe animals like pigs are more rational or self-aware than is a human infant. And so maybe we need to treat them the same. But he's starting to think that maybe there is something like objective ethical value out there, because a lot of the things he wants to promote require believing in something like objective ethical value beyond merely maximizing preference satisfaction. And so at age 65, he is now rethinking many of the ethical positions that he's held in the past. And I hope he keeps some of them, because I think some of them are really good. I haven't mentioned a lot of those yet. But obviously, some of the ones we've talked about already, I hope he does end up rejecting.
Well, let's start there. Why don't you just talk about some of the stuff in his work that is worth engagement from Christian ethicists?
Well, his coming out party on the academic scene was a 1972 article called Famine, Affluence, and Morality. And so from his very beginnings, he's been motivated primarily by reacting to suffering, vulnerable populations, especially the impoverished. And he told a famous shallow pond story where he asked us to imagine we're walking on our way to work and we see a little child drowning in a shallow pond, but we just don't go in and rescue the child because we just bought a really expensive pair of shoes that we will ruin in going to save the child. Would we think that somehow this was really a morally monstrous act? And most people end up saying, yes, it's a great example to use with undergraduates. And then he takes the next step and says, well, actually, every time that you buy an expensive pair of shoes, you're actually doing the equivalent of letting a child drown, because you could donate that money to Oxfam or Catholic Relief Services and save a child's life. So we need to radically rethink how we individually use resources in light of the suffering of the poor. And that is something that I try to show in the book. In fact, I have a whole chapter where I try to show that his views on poverty really mirror many of the most important understandings of our duties to the poor that Catholic social teaching has. There are some differences, and I talk about those as well, but it's really astounding, for instance, that both groups will say every consumptive choice we make is a moral issue, in part because it affects the poor in various ways.
Now, how about his, as you said, he's well known for his teachings on animal rights. That would seem to be an area where there's not a lot of overlap with Catholic social teaching or Christian ethics. What can we learn from Singer in this area?
Yeah, that's the view that a lot of people, including Singer, has. He thinks that the Judeo-Christian tradition is one of the main culprits in how we treat animals so terribly. He's particularly horrified, as I am, by how we treat other animals in factory farms, all the constant suffering that they undergo there. But as I try to show in a whole other chapter in the book on animals, I say, actually, he should really be blaming our current mechanized, consumerist, detached, profit-obsessed culture, not the Judeo-Christian tradition, which actually values animals a lot more than you may think, including our current pope, who, before he became pope, was interviewed and said that he thought that factory farming didn't cohere with the gospel's understanding of the relationship between human and non-human animals. And the Christian tradition also has a really important focus on creation, broadly speaking. Genesis famously says that creation is good, period, full stop, without reference to human beings, a very important moral principle, one that Singer would share. So that is an area of overlap as well. And so what he and I are currently working to try to plan some sort of conference or meeting or panel or something where we're trying to get Christians and secular folks to explore more deeply how we can mitigate against the suffering of non-human animals.
Now, you mentioned earlier some of these conferences that he's been involved in. You were involved in one yourself at Princeton University, where he's engaged with pro-lifers. Can you report back on how that went?
That 2010 conference at Princeton, I'm biased, of course, because I helped plan it, but I think it was a very important moment. I came away from Obama's 2009 address at Notre Dame back to Fordham thinking, man, we have to do something differently on the way we do the abortion debate in this country. And I wasn't sure what we were going to do, but to make a long story short, I just started asking around. And I had already developed a relationship with Professor Singer because I started to write this book, and he was giving me some feedback on his latest views. He was in the middle of writing another book himself. And we just started talking, and I said that I had this idea for a conference where we could try to think differently and speak differently about abortion with each other. And he was going to be one of the speakers for the conference. He agreed to that. And then, again, to make a long story short, he simply said, well, let's do it at Princeton. And then he and I and two other people got on a steering committee, and we managed to pull off an international conference with people of all sorts of persuasions about abortion that got together and talked about where we might find common ground, where we might have some disagreements, where we might continue dialogue. And I had a lot of interaction with him at this time, planning the conference, obviously, and got to know him pretty well.
Now, in terms of the abortion question, what were the areas that you found that kind of surprised you about perhaps areas of commonality?
Well, perhaps the most stunning one was that he thinks Roe versus Wade was wrongly decided. He comes from Australia, spent a lot of time in Europe, did his PhD at Oxford, where they have a legislative approach to abortion. Now, he is as pro-choice as they come. He's been pro-choice for infanticide. He thinks that we should, this is implied in what he said, but he has to think we need to overturn Roe versus Wade because he thinks that we should have a legislative approach to abortion in the United States. And he would prefer to see it be ensconced, the pro-choice position be ensconced via law, because he thinks one of the reasons we have such a screwed up debate in this country is because it was just, you know, imposed by judicial fiat. But that's a remarkable area of overlap. I can imagine the U.S. Catholic bishops getting on board with that and saying, yes, let's have a public debate. Let's actually have a debate that we never had with Roe versus Wade when it was just imposed by judicial fiat. Now, they would come to obviously very different conclusions about that, but that's to me a stunning example of common ground. At the conference, when he was talking about this, he said something very interesting. He said, I would be enraged if I was a pro-lifer and I managed to get a strong majority of people to think like I do on abortion, but I couldn't get the law changed. A pretty astounding moment of empathy, in my opinion, for people he vehemently disagrees with.
Well, maybe we could talk now more about your book. I know you address some of these issues, but you dig into it in a little more depth. So, you know, what was your approach? You know, why kind of dig into it in this level of a detail?
Well, you can do a podcast and say a few lines and people can sort of nod or roll their eyes or one or the other. But eventually you just have to make your case, right? You have to say, here are the texts. Here's where the Bible is very strong on animals. Here's where Peter Singer and Christian ethics, in my view, have so much in common on abortion. They disagree on one thing, a very narrow technical philosophical point. On every other issue, almost, they have widespread agreement. You know, you might say that. Anybody who knows you know, Singer's work and knows a traditional pro-life stance would say, what are you kidding me? You know, there's no possible way that's the case. So I wanted to write a book where I could show that this was the case and show that wide overlap on poverty and show that we have a concern for animals together, and to bring it all together in a way that is in a project that is engaged in something that I call intellectual solidarity. Actually, David Hollenbach called it that first, the ethicist at Boston College. And what intellectual solidarity is, it's an attempt to really listen and engage your opponent, or maybe perhaps better, your interlocutor, the person you're speaking with interacting with the best interest, his best interest or her best interest in mind, and saying, I want to learn from this person. I want to listen to this person. I also feel like I have something to say to this person. But instead of our polarized left, right, defined by opposition culture, this book attempts to try to really wrestle with his work and see him in the best possible light, never failing to be critical, of course. But intellectual solidarity is maybe the best way to talk about it.
You point out that this is actually a Christian tradition to engage the work of non-believers, going back to Aquinas dealing with Aristotle. So this is part of that larger project, is to engage people. And if you're looking for somebody who is, you know, seems most at odds with the church, Peter Singer would probably be a good place to start.
Yeah, maybe if I'm honest, that's part of what attracted me to this. It would seem so counterintuitive, but you're right. I mean, and we can even go back further than that, right? I mean, let's think about St. Paul going back to Corinth or Ephesus, talking with random Greeks about the gospel, right? He's engaging with them and meeting them on their own terms and saying, you have this temple to the unknown God. Let me explain to you what I think this is that's going on here. Thomas Aquinas, as you pointed out, famously engaged the pagan philosopher Aristotle and got in all kinds of trouble for doing it, right? The authorities of his day thought this was rightly sort of strange and weird that he would have done this. And yet Thomas Aquinas is now, you know, almost identified with official Catholic teaching. And so much of it came from the thought of the pagan philosopher Aristotle.
And you can point to, and you have to, that the church at the highest levels is starting to engage non-believers. There's this Court of the Gentiles project. Maybe you can introduce that.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's the church at its best is saying, we're going to remain engaged with the world. We're going to criticize where we think there needs to be criticism, of course, but we're not going to disengage. We're not going to isolate ourselves. We have a strong intellectual tradition. We want to respect the intellectual tradition of our interlocutors, and we want to have honest, open debate. And this was actually part of not only what was going on with the Forum for Nonbelievers, but also Benedict himself in Caritas in Veritate says flat out that we're supposed to engage nonbelievers. He even calls for what he calls fraternal collaboration with nonbelievers at the service of peace and justice in the human family.
And that initiative is called the Courtyard of the Gentiles, which is aimed to promote dialogue between believers and nonbelievers. And that's being convened by the Pontifical Council for Culture. And I do believe that Benedict himself seems to be pretty enthusiastic about this particular project.
Yeah, and it's not surprising because before he became Pope, he was involved in a very high-profile engagement with Jürgen Habermas on many different kinds of issues, including how, you know, religion and secular culture should interact in Europe. So he is no stranger to this, and it's no surprise that under his pontificate, it's been higher profile.
I want to talk a little bit about, before we end, about your thisCatholicMoralTheology.com. This is a project, it seems to be in the similar vein in trying to bring Catholic tradition, but also engage with the world outside of the church. Maybe you can introduce that.
My friend Tobias Winwright and I were sitting at a conference, unbelievably, in Trento, Italy, just sort of overlooking the church that opened the Council of Trent and, you know, sipping on cappuccinos and talking and thinking big thoughts. And we thought, you know what we need? We need a blog. And a bunch of us just got together and talked and thought, well, what can we do? These were all Christian ethicists or moral theologians. All of us, you know, fairly young, but probably all under 50. And just thought we need a way to interact with each other. We need a way to interact with the world. We need a way to respond to stories as they, you know, break and be able to comment on them. Tomorrow, our time at least, is the big healthcare announcement. We're going to obviously be talking about that there. So, but also we wanted to try to find a way to make it academically serious at the same time. and also to find a way to reach the broader world, which is tough row to hoe. So we have, I don't know, maybe 16 or 17 moral theologians on there who post from time to time. And if there's something going on in the church that's probably related to politics or ethics in the news, you can come and find us talking about it there.
Well, Charlie Camosi of Fordham University is the author of Peter Singer and Christian Ethics Beyond Polarizations, published by Cambridge University Press. Thank you for joining us, Charlie.
It's been great to be here.